You're listening to The Dirt on the Past, a show on history and archaeology and why it matters today. You can find us on the Extreme History Project website and also on kgbm.org. Thanks for listening. Welcome to The Dirt on the Past from the Extreme History Project and KGBM Community Radio.
Whether digging up a site or dusting off the archives, we bring you some of the most fascinating and cutting-edge research in history and archaeology, and discuss why it matters today. Join me, Nancy Mahoney, alongside co-host Crystal Alegria, as we converse with anthropologists, archaeologists,
and historians about how they bring the past alive.
Hey there, and welcome everyone to this week's edition of the show. I'm Nancy.
And I'm Crystal.
And we are the co-hosts of The Dirt on the Past. This week, we are at the Extreme History offices speaking in person with Betsy Gaines Quammen, a historian and author of American Zion, Clive and Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West. Betsy, we're so excited to have you here, and we want to start off, as we always do, by telling our listeners a little bit about you. Dr. Betsy Gaines Quammen, such a pleasure to say Dr. Betsy Gaines Quammen, because I was actually at your defense, which was wonderful. She is a historian and a conservationist. She holds a doctorate in environmental history from Montana State University, and her dissertation focused on Mormon settlement and public land conflicts. She has studied various religious traditions over the years, with particular attention to how cultures view landscape and wildlife. The rural American West, pastoral communities of northern Mongolia, and the grasslands of East Africa have been her main areas of interest. So welcome, Betsy.
Thank you so much for having me. I've been doing podcasts on American Zion, but this is the first one I've done in person. And it's actually really fun to be seeing you beautiful ladies across the table
of
women.
It's so
yes.
Nice,
academics.
Right? Yeah, ladies is fine. We'll take any
we'll
of them.
We'll take ladies, yeah. Yeah, I know. It's so fun to do them in person when we can. Most of the time we're doing them on Zoom, which is great, too,
yeah.
To be able to have Zoom. But, you know, in person is the best.
I agree.
And it's great.
And
it
translates, I think, to the listener's experience also. So.
So, Betsy, we wanted to talk with you a little bit about how you came to this research and how you came to this work. And so talk a little bit about your road to environmental history and then your road to writing about this mix of culture, religion, and the West.
Sure. Yeah, my road was a circuitous one. I was working in this building.
That's right.
Yes.
You said that when you came in.
So I'm really excited to be in this building today. I was working in this building for an environmental organization, and I worked on grizzly bear and bull trout protection. And I really felt like the organization was a wonderful organization and is a wonderful organization that they're now based in Helena. Mm-hmm. But I really felt like we weren't reaching broad audiences with these messages. And we were essentially talking to one another. Everybody that I spoke with looked like me and voted like me.
Right.
And I thought that was not particularly effective. So I began to think about how do you reach broad audiences? How do you build coalitions? And I started working with religious organizations. And that took me into Mongolia, working with Buddhist monks on fisheries conservation. And as a matter of fact, I am going to be doing a conference in the next couple of weeks with these networks that I still work with in Mongolia. I'm speaking at a Mongolian Buddhist conference that I will be doing on Zoom. I won't be in person, yeah. Although I was going to be teaching a class there this summer on Mongolian Buddhism with our Mongolian monk partners. But because of the Ukrainian ticket prices are expensive, and COVID's still really sort of weird, especially if people were flying through China. So that's been put on hold, but I still have, you know, really great relationships over there. And I realized that, we realized as a team working with these lamas, these scientists from University of Nevada, Reno, that messages were more pertinent in these communities if they came from local traditions, sure. Rather than going in and saying, you know, you got to protect a minimum viable population of your taimen, which was the salmonid, this trout that we were working on. There was a sutra that said the death of one taimen, which is the fish, equals the souls of 999 people suffering.
Wow.
And when you bring across messages that resonate with various cultures, depending on where they are geographically or what they believe, their the particular worldview, that's when you start to build better coalitions. It's a way of engaging the community and understanding them, and it's way more effective. And I'm talking to you, and I'm sure that sounds really obvious, but for me, it was, well, I better go back and really review how I communicate with people if I want people to be good conservationists. And so my original idea was to do my dissertation on Mongolian Buddhism and conservation.
Right.
But it would have taken me a lot longer to learn to access primary texts in Mongolian. I have this really dorky joke, which is, Mini Mongol Helmo, which is the only Mongolian I speak, which means my Mongolian sucks.
well said.
Yeah. I know, I've been told I have kind of a good accent.
Yeah.
but I
you say that one like a native, right?
Yeah, I know. I love to throw that out. And I do throw it out, and then people start just rapid fire speaking to me in Mongolian. So, I'm like, really, mini Mongol Helmo. I decided that I needed to do something that I could access primary texts and read it. And lo and behold, Mormon history is a treasure trove. It's in English, and it is absolutely, as a historian, it is dizzying in the amount of material, oral traditions, letters, church doctor. I mean, it was so incredibly wonderful as a historian, and it was so different in terms of the way environment was perceived. Mm. So the way that LDS or Latter-day Saints see and appreciate landscape was very, very different than, even Christian evangelical groups that we were working with, Jewish groups, Muslim groups. We worked with the Sikhs, and then we worked in Mongolia with these Buddhist monks. We worked in Bhutan with Buddhist monks. But the Mormon worldview was very different, and I had to, as a conservationist, sort of step back and look at how landscape was perceived, and in this case, how landscape was perceived and in some ways started these land use wars.
Right. And that must have been a little more challenging, I just think. First of all, to your point that it may seem obvious to us when you said that, I think it's, to me, when I first heard of your work in looking at religion and conservation and environmentalism, I was really intrigued by that idea and hadn't heard a lot of discussion and research about it. And it right away seemed like a very smart approach because it does take you to the heart of core belief systems that groups have. And then I think that would be something you're prepared for when you're going into Bhutan or Mongolia or somewhere else. But to be in your own country, I would think you think, oh, I share an American culture, even though this group of people is Mormon. I would think it would actually take an extra effort to sort of remember that there could be very different worldview there that you were accessing, and to be hyper aware of whatever bias I might be bringing if I were doing it. So I think that's fascinating. Perspective.
I knew nothing about Mormon history or culture. I mean, almost nothing. And it was really fascinating. And, this is a uniquely American religion.
Absolutely.
I mean, that came out of the Second Great Awakening. You think of the ones that came out of that. Mormonism, Seventh-day Adventists, Shakers,
right.
Which, they believed in abstinence, so they're no longer with us. The Odinians.
Yep.
But this And this religion came out of that fervor of the Second Great Awakening, which was, you know, all speaking in tongues and brimstone and fiery preachers. And this religion has not only remained, but it has thrived.
Yes.
And they have some incredibly good Mormon academics. I mean, I have been unbelievably impressed with the members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that are academics at either BYU, University of Utah, also Utah State. Rigorous, brilliant. I've really liked interacting with Mormon scholars.
My husband's photography work, in which he collaborates with scientists, and it's all focused around environmental subjects, retreating glaciers, deep time ways of understanding the earth and what the scientist work is doing. And so his work is these massive images that are then annotated by the scientists that he's collaborating with, whether he's climbing to the top of Kilimanjaro, photographing glaciers that they're researching, or whether he's photographing bristlecone pines, some of the oldest trees, and that work. But he was given a show in Rexburg, and it's a Mormon, completely
yeah.
Mormon yeah. University
That's BYU
there.
Rexburg.
Exactly.
In Idaho.
And he was so impressed, also, as you say. So very open and interested, and people who say, well, I'm a scientist, and the way they're approaching the information. So it very interesting, complex, complicated, I think, culture and approach to understanding the world that has this pretty short history,
yeah.
as you say,
yeah.
that you can access. I love that you said mm-hmm. in so many different ways, whether it's church records, actual, you know, Bibles that have been written, as well as oral histories and other documents.
We're so close to that origin point of this religion.
Yeah.
You mm-hmm. know, if you think about that too, that you're writing something about this religion and it's in its infancy, really. So
completely.
Yeah.
And I think that that's been, really wonderful, you know, and it also, I mean, I'm right now, okay, this is the coolest thing. I am part of a watch group with Sunstone, which is a wonderful magazine that comes out of, you know, Mormon culture, and it just really, I mean, I know that if somebody's listening and they're a big reader of Sunstone, they might take issue of the way I explain this, but I think of it as the Utney reader of mm-hmm. Mormon culture. I just think it's so great. And I'm doing a watch party with Under the Banner of Heaven, and the members of this watch party, it's like 3,000 people.
Wow.
And it's devout members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It's people who are disgruntled, who've left mm-hmm. the church. It's mm-hmm. academics. It's non-Mormons. And it is, I have never seen a social media platform that is so cordial, that is so well, each point is so well articulated. Mm. Everybody's so extremely knowledgeable. It's a blast.
Wow,
and,
interesting.
And it includes Brenda Lafferty's sister, Brenda Lafferty being the woman who was murdered.
So this is Under the Banner of Heaven, and where is it on Hulu?
It's on Facebook. Oh, Hulu
is the series on
yeah,
Hulu?
And then this is a Facebook discussion
and so
group.
So then you watch, and then everybody...
And then everybody
that's
pipes
so
in.
Interesting.
It's,
wow.
It's
that's
wonderful.
That's a great book. A book by, is it John
Krakauer?
Krakauer, yeah.
I love that book, and yeah. I love John Krakauer's writing. The church took issue with it mm-hmm. in some regards. So it's just a really interesting format to see how these things are playing out and the arguments that are happening.
Yeah.
But everybody's so impeccably respectful of one another.
Oh, how wonderful.
And but you're seeing, in any case, I don't want to get too off the path, but I just really think that because it's such a new religion and people are so well versed in the history of the church, they really, there are so many really, really knowledgeable members of LDS that have incredible interest in history, that you're seeing these discussions and they're extremely rich and well-informed.
Wow.
So, well, that's something maybe we can even throw a link up to when we post this on their Facebook page.
Yeah.
So let's turn now to your book, American Zion, Clive and Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West, which was published originally in 2020, but you said it's also in a second printing.
It's going to be. So, which is really...
Congratulations.
Thank you. That makes me so excited.
So your book explores the ideas of Mormon family, the Bundys in particular, their conflicts that a lot of people know about because it's been in the media with the federal government over grazing leases on public land. You discuss in the book the history of the Mormon religion in relation to land and in relation to work ethic and industry. And you bring then this history to the present, discussing how the Bundys and families like theirs have been mixing spiritualism, patriotism, and wilderness to assert possession over Western federal lands. So to start off by telling us a little bit about how the Mormon Church ended up in the West, because it didn't officially start there, in what we now refer to as Utah, what is now legally Utah, and also talk about, if you can, the people who occupied that land prior to Mormon settlement.
Yeah, those are great questions. So, and I think that really sets up the thesis of the book, which is competing notions of sacred space. So you had the Southern Paiute who lived, again, there are any number of tribes that were living in what came to be known as Zion, which is sacred Mormon homeland.
Right.
That was promised by Joseph Smith. He was told by God, this was a prophecy, that the Mormon people would have a sacred homeland, that they could settle and they could be safe in practicing this new religion, because there was quite a bit of oppression in the United States. And they were first in upstate New York, and then they were in Ohio, and then they planned on building Zion in Missouri. Well, the Mormons were abolitionists, so they came to a state that there were slaveholders there, and there was a big concern on the part of slaveholders that the Mormons were going to vote in abolitionists. And so they were essentially run out of the state. I mean, it was a brutal chapter in Mormon history. A massacre at Hans Mill where children were killed, where adults were killed by these Missouri mobs. They ran the Mormon people into Illinois, and that's where Joseph Smith was going to establish Zion in Nauvoo. And a number of things happened at this point. I mean, as I explained in my book, I really think that he began to become power hungry, and the Mormon people would disagree. I mean, I that I think is fine. There's different ways of viewing this, but he was running for president. He was telling people that that men were gods. Mm-hmm. He at this point put forth his idea of polygamy. Mm-hmm. And
he said even God had been a man at once, right? And that men could become gods or things like that. So he was really saying some things that
were
lots of people were taking issue with.
Right, that they thought were heretical. Mm-hmm. And so he had internal strife as well as external. There were a number of non-Mormons in the area who wanted him out of there. And there was a occurrence where the people within his church that were really unhappy with polygamy in particular, but also this doctrine about God as men, they published a newspaper and condemned Joseph Smith, but not the church. And Joseph Smith got angry. He destroyed the printing press. And there was, the state intervened. He was sent to jail, and then he was killed. He was murdered. And so when that happened, Brigham Young took over and took the Mormon people from this region to the West. And at that point, it was still Mexican territory. So he wanted to take them out of the United States. So the Mormons have a very long history of anti-government sentiment. So they brought Zion, Mormon homeland, with them, this promise that God gave them a territory to practice the religion safely That came to the Great Basin and the Colorado Plateau. There were plans, this state of Deseret, to occupy the space essentially from Mexico all the way up through Oregon. And that's why when you go to Idaho, that there's still Mormon homeland there, because that was where
part
Brigham
of that
Young.
Whole yeah
that,
yeah
that okay. makes sense
he was
now.
He
yeah.
was sending people yeah. to settle in those areas. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's how Mormon homeland was established, but it was established over sacred land that belonged, in the case of the territory I'm talking about where the Bundys live, the Southern Paiute people.
Okay, and that's it. Is that more in Nevada?
That's in Nevada and Utah.
And Utah. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
And the Southern Paiute were a people who did not have horses. So they were really vulnerable to other tribes that had horses. And they were kidnapped. They were sold as slaves. The Ute sold them.
Right,
that
other
was a
tribes,
nearby.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they believed that their God had given them the land, and that it was the best land. And instead of settling the land, which is the way Joseph Smith said, in order to make a place sacred, it needs to be built. With the Southern Paiute, the land was sacred because of its abundance. And so it wasn't a built landscape. It was a landscape that you traveled through seasonally, harvesting various food and hunting various
wildlife. So very different notions of sacredness
right.
tied to the land.
But
and in what way you honored or enjoyed that sacredness.
Absolutely.
Right.
The similarity is that God bestowed the land to both mm. these groups. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the way that the Mormon people utilized the land, and they built around water sources, and they farmed areas that had this natural food source, there are very few Southern Paiute still today because mm-hmm. they essentially starved them.
They mm-hmm. could then not sustain their life way right. of moving right. through the land anymore.
Right, right. It's a beautiful culture, and the way that they moved across the land, they would sing these salt songs. That's if you ever have a chance to look into
wow.
the history of the Southern Paiute, it was a moving. They would move along the landscapes. They would harvest, and then they'd sing these gorgeous salt songs. And it's just, I had the great pleasure of interviewing some Southern Paiute, and they're amazing people. And they survived. I mean, you know, they have survived. There are not very many Southern Paiute enrolled today, but there are some wonderful people who are extremely, very, very invested in their culture.
Was it a violent conflict when Mormons came to that area where the Paiute were, or were they working to adopt Paiute into their belief system and settle them on the land and into their church?
That's a great question. The Southern Paiute, probably more than any other tribe, there's still many Southern Paiute Mormons today. Mm-hmm. The Navajo also converted mm-hmm. to Mormonism, but the relationship that the Mormons had with the Southern Paiute is different in the sense that the Mormons did offer some protection from these slave raiders.
Right.
And so that was an advantageous relationship. There were Southern Paiute who did convert, as I said, and there were also there's a very, I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the history of the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Okay. Right.
There was collaboration.
You discussed that in your book.
Yeah,
yeah.
On the part of the Mormons and the Southern Paiutes in that massacre where 120 people moving through the territory
from Arkansas, right?
Yeah. were murdered. So there is a history with the Southern Paiute and, mm-hmm. and the Mormons.
An intermarriage between the two?
There was some. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. there was some for sure. Yeah.
Well, that history is fascinating. And You know, I had no idea about most of that, you know, with them in Missouri, with the Mormon Church in Missouri and Illinois, and then coming out here into this place that was not the United States at that point, you know, coming into this, into these territories. So that was, that part of the book was really fascinating to me. But I want to move a little bit and talk about some of the terminology that you use, Betsy, in the book, and you, some of the terminology that you unpack in the book, which I think is really, really important for us to better understand. And one of those words that you use is the word cowboy. And so, you know, there's a lot of mythologies in the West, and there's a lot of myth out there. And we talk about this all the time on the podcast.
Oh, yes.
And one of those things that we end up talking a lot about is that idea of the cowboy. And the cowboy today is really such a dominant mythological figure in the West, symbolizing things like self-sufficiency, that silent strength and individualistic freedom. But in reality, and you talk about this in your book so well, you talk about the cowboy in that he was a person who worked for a boss. He was, you know, told where to go, when to go, and how
just
to go.
Just a hired hand.
Yeah, he was just a hired hand, you know. So really kind of different. And then also cowboys in the West were often, they're often now depicted as white, but often they were black or Latino. And so a lot of different, not always the white cowboy, the white stoic cowboy that we often see depicted. So I want you just to talk a little bit about that. And that's going to kind of set up some things that we talk about later, that,
okay,
that mythology of the West, but the mythology more specifically of the cowboy.
And there were also indigenous cowboys and are indigenous cowboys. You know, there are a number of ranchers that are Native people. Mm-hmm. I've read that a third of the cowboys out West were black.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that we forget. I also, there were, and this isn't something I write about in American Zion, but there was a huge population of Chinese people who were working on they weren't cowboys necessarily, but we do think of the West as white, and we were historically a very diverse place. And so I think that's really important to emphasize and remember. The cowboy is interesting because, as you said, the cowboy was just a hired hand. And the way that image has been elevated and mythologized is really interesting. And I think about the Bundys in particular. So American Zion is about the history of why the Bundys launched their war. And they're ranchers in Nevada. And they, 1993, Clive and Bundy stopped paying grazing fees, and he illegally grazed his cows in this part of the Mojave Desert that has a long history of Mormon settlement, but, you know, it's also Southern Paiute land. So the Moapa band of the Southern Paiute live right next to Clive and Bundy's place. And when I met I think his name is Greg Anderson. It's been a while since I've written this book, but he talked about ranching in that area too. And it was really important to him. You know, when I said something about, well, cows maybe shouldn't be in the Mojave, he said, well, they are fine in the Mojave, and I used to ranch there, you know, growing up, and talked about essentially his right to ranch the land as an indigenous person. So I really have found that people have different ways of perceiving the land, just like we talked about before the podcast. But one of the things that the Bundys have done is they've really embraced this cowboy myth as the good guys, the white hats, and when the first standoff happened in 2014 with the federal government, and the federal government came in to confiscate the cows that had been illegally grazing there, they were able to engage between 750 and 1,000 members of the militia. And I think that there was a real interest in jumping in and fighting this battle because of the cowboy mythology. Here we are, we're having a standoff in the West with the government who's heavy-handed, and you know, we're with these family and we're with this family and they're facing cattle rustlers, which is literally what they were calling the government. And so it was so Wild West. And when they the government did back off, because it was very, very close to
being. There were guns everywhere.
There were guns everywhere, you know, aimed at each other, law enforcement and the militia. And when the government backed off, Ryan Bundy, Clive and Bundy's son, said, "The West has now been won." So it goes back to that Western mythology of the West has been won. I mean, that's the gunslingers and the... that's colonial settlement. That's the Indian Wars. And so I think that that mythology plays so much into the Bundy story. The other thing that's very interesting is when Ammon Bundy was in court in, at the, you know, during the Malheur, this was in Portland, over the Malheur occupation, which happened 2 years after the standoff in Nevada. He wanted to wear his cowboy hat and cowboy garb, his outfit in court. He wanted to dress as a cowboy because he felt like that was so important in terms of optics. He didn't want to be in his prison jumpsuit. He wanted to be dressed as a cowboy because he really felt like that would be more persuasive to the jury. And he wasn't allowed. But I think that the fact that they knew that cowboy imagery resonates, and we think of cowboys as good guys.
Which historically, I mean, you talk in the book, you've done, so many people have done work on this, but you've talked too about the Virginian and that Owen Whistler, you know, book that became many movies and different representations. And it's kind of a strange mix of, you said, Eastern genteel sort of almost noble way of interacting, like sort of that good guy that would help you, who'd ride up on the horse and save the day. But then, you know, he was a hired hand, goes out west, and then eventually becomes a landowner in Wyoming. But that whole mythology of the Virginian itself wasn't really based in many true life examples. No. And cowboys themselves were not something you'd really ever want your daughter to date, you know? And so it is so interesting that the optic of what a cowboy means now, the one thing that thread that has come through is that self-reliance and individualism that you make such a good point about being, that sense of freedom, but that's also that sense of like hard-won entitlement, I think.
I agree. And again, it's just, you know, myth after myth that's been, because the entitlement to the land, I mean, this land was indigenous land. And it was the settled. And in American Zion, and this I do think that there's a sense of entitlement in other places besides the area that I was focused on, which was Mormon homeland. But there was entitlement in the sense that Joseph Smith promised them sacred homeland. So this land that's sacred homeland, that's to the Mormon people and to the Southern Paiute, is also public land. And so it's this sense of entitlement to public land as well. And I think that that's where things become problematic. And in terms of the cowboy as a symbol, the way that we've created it, the way that we've set it up, just as you said, he's genteel, he's fair, he's not really Western, he's Eastern. He's taking Eastern manners.
And honorability and manners.
Yes. And it's a weird concoction.
But then you think of Ryan Zinke when he got, you know, appointed. He rides down the streets of Washington, D.C. on a horse with a cowboy hat on. And you're like, this is a military guy. And I'm sure, you know, this was, I mean, it's powerful, fascinating, but we're constantly seeing it used and used and used over and over again to send these messages that have this long, complicated history.
Well, and he is really playing into the whole Teddy Roosevelt,
You know, because it's the idea of the national parks and
Teddy Roosevelt wrote about going west, and he was in South Dakota, North Dakota.
Yes,
and how that's really where you become a man. Mm-hmm. And so he used that sort of rite of passage in becoming a cowboy, or knowing how to do that rugged, you know, sort of work. That's what makes a man out of you. So it's got layers.
There's layers to it. There's lots of layers to it. And, you know, so I want to, are we ready to move off the cowboy and on to something else?
And we're going to, with that, take a quick station break. You are listening to The Dirt on the Pass with co-hosts Crystal Alegria and Nancy Mahoney on KGVM Bozeman, or wherever you find your podcasts. We're speaking today with author and historian Betsy Gaines Quammen about her book, American Zion, Cliven and Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West.
Okay, so we're going to move away from the cowboy. Let's say that. And we're going to talk a little bit about public land, just to kind of give more context for the story that you're going to tell as we go on. So, and to give a little more context about public land. So let's talk about the Bureau of Land Management, the BLM, and public land management. So the BLM was created in 1946. And it was Congress created the BLM by merging the General Land Office and the U.S. Grazing Service. So you say in your book, and I love how you say this, I love how you describe the BLM, quote, the BLM's mission was to manage the, air quotes, leftovers of federal land, all the places not identified as scenic attractions, such as those managed by the Park Service, or sources of timber, such as those managed by the Forest Service, end quote. So that's a great sum, you know, in a sentence about what the BLM does. And this is a huge swath of land that the BLM manages. Most of it is in the West. There's a few BLM parcels in the East, but most of it resides in the West. And as time goes on, there are many restrictions put on this land. And I'm not going to name all the ones you did in the book, all the laws and acts, but I just want to mention a couple to give folks a better understanding of some of these laws that were created after that 1946 development of the BLM. So one of those things that Nancy and I really appreciate and work with quite a bit is the 1979 Archaeological Resources Protection Act, which is also referred to as ARPA. And this is a federal law that governs the excavation of archaeological sites on federal and Indian lands in the United States and the removal and disposition of archaeological collections from those sites. Other laws, like the Federal Land Policy and Management Act of 1976, are also put into place. And with these acts, the BLM was tasked with protecting the ecological integrity of these places, basically. That's what it was doing. And this is kind of where things get a little bit dicey, and people start to question these laws and question these restrictions and these protections, which we see as protections, but not everybody sees these as protections. So can you speak to how people responded to these laws and to this creation of this public land and to BLM more recently?
It's really interesting. Basically, what you are referring to is the time that ranchers living in these areas next to BLM faced restrictions. And this had been something that they had not expected or been accustomed to. And so there were restrictions in terms of the Taylor Grazing Act, which at first was quite popular, and I think that was in 1936, because the Taylor Grazing Act, it was really necessary. Land was getting overgrazed, and this was a way to manage that. And the people managing the allotments, which were the leases, the federal land leases, were the ranchers themselves. So there wasn't government oversight. It was the ranchers deciding how to stock their land, essentially. Okay. Or public land, not their land.
Yeah.
So when you had the advent of the Endangered Species Act, the FLPMA, which is the Federal Land Management Policy Act, and NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, or Protection Act. Anyway, Protection Act. You started to have rules and regulations that folks that had been ranching this land had not yet needed to adhere to. And there was this real large pushback, which what really got people angry was the when BLM land started being assessed for wilderness. And and so wilderness study areas were areas that were 5,000 acres or larger that were roadless. And so you had people who, you know, hearing wilderness, which is the most restrictive designation, it really sent people in over the edge.
They that were was furious. The tipping point for a lot of them.
And the beginning of the Sagebrush Rebellion.
Right.
And so those restrictions... And I think that, you know, just in terms of what we're seeing today, people don't like restrictions. I mean, they don't like mask mandates. Mm-hmm. They don't like stay at home. And that's been really weird because in 2020, I talked to Ammon Bundy because I thought, oh, God, COVID's going to be the next Mal here. That was really my thought because when you get down to it, what they're pushing back on are affronts to liberty. Mm-hmm. And so the laws that were put in place in this many in the 70s were affronts to liberty. And we're seeing that same anger manifested, you know, sort of coming out in regards to COVID. And so Ammon has become really, really involved in the quote unquote medical freedom movement. Mm-hmm. He's a big anti-vaxxer. He's taken this, you know, sort of, he's become, they were very focused on public lands and that's where they came to, you know, came into notoriety. And now he's really rode that and has sort of established himself as this pro-liberty figure. Mm-hmm. So it, with the roots that go back right back to what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, that's not surprising that, you know, he would have moved right into the anti-vax and the you know, all the mask restrictions and all that. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. And he's running for governor of Idaho now.
Oh, he is?
Yeah.
Oh. Wow. Well,
his brother Ryan ran for governor of Nevada in 2018, I think.
And did not.
He didn't win.
Right. And so we'll watch this other new race.
Yeah.
It's fascinating to me because a lot of the BLM lands were also the leftovers in the sense that they weren't homesteaded. And I think so much of the potential that they could have been become private land and that they were adjacent to other private properties, the sense that they could have come, you know, out of the public domain into the private, that all went away when you changed the General Land Office and the Grazing Service merged to the BLM. And increasingly over time, right, more federal oversight. But we do have those protections going back to the beginning of the Forest Service, and you mentioned the Taylor Grazing Act and those things, but it seems like that tipping point is really, and the Sagebrush Rebellions, and you have Ronald Reagan really riding a lot of that into office, into 1980, and being really aware that there was a lot of support, because he was also for small government, less government, and that played right into these ideas, right?
States
so there's
rights.
There's all this overlap, right? But they, you know, you mentioned in your book, and other people have talked about that, this idea of releasing those large tracts that we see on a map that are all ostensibly public land, BLM land, that aren't necessarily even in a park or anything. But if you were to give those to the states that they are contained within, the borders within, people were saying, well, those would probably go into private hands pretty quickly. And as you've pointed out, Bundy and so many others who graze on public lands have an amazing subsidy, right? They are being subsidized from the government when they're paying it, subsidized even more when they're not. But it is a government subsidy that provides them with access to all this extra land that they would not be able to have to graze their cows if that land became private. And so it's a really interesting nut to look at from the outside, that there's this no anger really against private landholders, because this idea of entitlement, privacy, keep the government out. But the anger is all on the government, who's providing actually quite minimal restrictions, except in the case of wilderness designation, which is still quite a small part.
And you can graze on wilderness. I mean, it's you can't build roads. And there's a wonderful book by...
So the cowboy goes in and rounds up. So what's the problem?
Well, it's because and this is something that the Jed Rogers, who's a historian, he's fantastic. And he's at the Utah Historical Society. And he's written a book, and I think it's called Roads in the Wilderness, about the religious significance of roads in Utah and how they represented pilgrimages or journeys that the Mormon settlers took across some of the most inhospitable landscape. It wasn't settled for a reason. These are not easy places to settle. So they moved across landscape, and they have old trails that represent their fortitude. And so he talks about sacralizing landscapes through trailblazing.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the reasons why these roadless areas were so offensive, his point being that they were saying these areas were roadless, where in fact they were storied places of Mormon, you know, Mormon families moving across harsh landscapes. So I think that's a really interesting book and well worth reading. I loved that book. But in terms of, there was another thing, Nancy, that you mentioned, and I'm trying to think of.
Was it having to do with grazing fees?
The fact, yes. So, they are really subsidized. I think a cow-calf pair now is cheaper than $1.50. So a mom and calf on public land per month, and it's called an animal unit, an AUM, animal unit monthly, is less than $1.50. It's very inexpensive, but this is something I've thought a lot about because there's a huge effort to give it to the states, and Utah politicians have been particularly interested in this. Mike Lee, Mitt Romney, they do not believe that public land should be federal. And so it would be incredibly expensive for someone like Clive and Bundy to buy his allotments, even though they're not his allotments, but he's still grazing on them. It would be incredibly expensive for a rancher who does not make very much money. It's very hard to make a livelihood as a rancher. They wouldn't be the people who could afford this land. The uber wealthy could afford this land. And the truth is, one of the largest landowners in the country is the church. Mm. They're one of the largest landowners. Mm. So
in Utah, do they believe that the church would buy most of the federal
land? I don't know, but it is very interesting to think that those pushing for privatization, many of them are affiliated with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who is aggressively buying land. Bill Gates and the church are two of the biggest landowners in the United States. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but I do wonder if the church thinks that by privatizing public lands, they could be in the position to buy them, because it would be extremely expensive to buy public lands.
It's just fascinating that all of the vitriol at the federal government and their management of it, without any real recognition among certain groups, that they're getting such a phenomenal deal of this. And just on a side tangent, you also discuss briefly, which is so important in there, just that whole concept of wilderness anyway is so strange. And I think you just brought that point right home by bringing up the book. We're talking about these movement through the lands, the marks left in, you know, trying to make trails, forge trails, and then to have roadless areas. I mean, we know there are no places untrammeled by man, and that whole idea itself is a bit problematic. But that's a completely different podcast. So
a very interesting one.
Yeah.
And I do have to say that I think that that has been a really rich discussion in conservation groups. And, you know, Bill Cronin, who was the first one to really bring that out there, is now on the board of the Wilderness Society. So I think it's really, I mean, wilderness as a designation has a wonderful benefit to ecosystem health, but I do think the idea of wilderness deserves to be unpacked, and it's getting unpacked. Mm-hmm. You know, especially in looking at wilderness, that concept as a white male, you know, Thoreauvian or Emersonian maybe, or you know, these guys with completely completely disregarding the indigenous settlement of these places indigenous
use of these places all the time for their livelihood. Exactly. So so we know that that's, but I have still been in some circles where I have mistakenly said that the it's fascinating, this invention of wilderness as a concept, and I'll get blank stares and realize I'm not reading the room correctly. So there's still a lot of discussions.
Well, and there are certain conservationists who get really angry. I don't feel like it's dangerous to teach history. I mean, and that's what you all represent. So anyway,
right.
We all
read your William Cronin out there, folks.
We cling to our myths.
Very good story.
We do.
So getting back to your book and all of the lovely tangents that we could go on from it, I want to talk about the Bundy family, which features so prominently in the book, and it's through this lens of understanding them as a family and historically that you make your argument. So tell us a little bit about the history of the Bundy family and even the ancestral history up through today, as well as how you came to know them and really why you chose them as this central thread for your story.
So I was working on Mormon settlement as a topic of my dissertation, and I initially started looking at the collaborative effort between the emerging Park Service, the brand new Park Service, and the Mormon settlers in and around the Virgin River by Zion Canyon. And it's a really, really great story. It was very collaborative. I think it was the only collaborative land, you know, sort of protection and park designation in that area. Things went downhill from there. But it was very harmonious, and I think the testament is that it's named Zion National Park. I mean, the National Park Service
went ahead and
they used that designation. So it became less collaborative after that. And when the Bundys, I didn't know about the Bundys until the 2014. Actually, maybe I'd heard about, I know they hadn't paid grazing fees, but, you know, as I say in the book, I thought these guys were outliers, and it turns out that they are not. Just looking at how their actions, I really feel have given motivation to this ever, ever growing militia movement that we saw at the Capitol on January 16th. I think the Bundys are a really big piece of that.
This recent January 6th.
January 6th.
No, there is a line. I think you've made it. Yeah. So we'll get to that later. But
sorry,
yes.
Did I say January 6th?
I know that's
insurrection.
What you meant.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I
felt like it went on for 10 days.
Well, yeah. God, it feels like it's still going on.
Right.
Yeah. So in any case, I went and I called the family on a landline. They were listed.
Wow.
And so I called and talked to Carol, Cliven's wife, and they invited me down.
Wow.
And I went down. Actually, they were so nice to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to their house and I sat in their living room under a painting by that artist who did all the Trump swamp paintings. Do you know who I'm talking about? He's actually
yes.
LDS too.
I don't know yes. who this is.
Well, it's in my book.
Okay.
I can't remember
yeah.
his name off
okay.
the top of my head. But he was an artist that glorified Trump, but he also painted
okay.
Cliven Bundy. Cliven Bundy wrapped
yes.
in a flag.
Yes.
And
uh-huh.
so I sat in their living room and I spoke to them both, and then Ryan came in, and then...
And so Ryan is the brother of...
Ammon.
Yeah. And so Ammon and Carol are married.
No.
Cliven.
And Carol are married.
Okay.
Ammon is their son.
Her stepson.
Okay.
He was married before.
Okay.
Ammon and Ryan have a different mom.
Okay.
I see.
And then Buddha, who is Brian Cavalier, who was Cliven's bodyguard.
Okay.
And I talked to them for a very long time about Mormon worldview and about their ancestors, one of which was Nephi Johnson, who was, according to the history, the first white man to explore Zion Canyon, the park. And he married Cliven's great-grandmother, Cliven's grandfather, his third wife. She had lost her husband, and he spiritually adopted her whole family when he married her. And so Cliven's grandfather is Johnny Jensen, But it was his, so I should, I'm going in so many directions. Nephi Johnson was a big figure in that area, and okay. he participated in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here he was exploring Zion Canyon. He participated in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. He fled during the, when they were cracking down on polygamy and went to Mexico and moved around the area. Johnny Jensen was Cliven's grandfather, but Cliven's father was the one who bought the property, I think, in 1947. So Cliven makes this big claim that, you know, we've been on this land for all this time. Well, he's had ancestors that have been in and around the area, but the place he is right now, his father bought.
Two generations.
Right, yeah. Right. Okay. So when I talked to him, you know, that we were talking about that, we were talking about the spiritual significance of the Constitution, which has deep roots in early church theology. And the family, as I said, they were very nice to me. And, you know, it wasn't until driving away that I thought, wow, these people have motivated a dangerous group of people. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Can I briefly ask you about something that I found fascinating in the book that I hadn't realized before, was that Joseph Smith, the originator of Mormonism, had ideas about who Native Americans actually were, going back to biblical times and Noah and his son Ham, who was cast out after seeing Noah, you know, doing something he shouldn't have been or in a compromising way. And then this idea, you said sometime like in the Middle Ages, became associated with darker skin. And so there was this sense that this was sort of a lost tribe that had been mentioned in the Bible, all Native Americans. And it's interesting because in the early, you know, 1800s, 1830s, 1840s, you know, there were so many ideas, myths of mound builders, archaeologists didn't know what they were doing. You know, there were all these ideas about who were these Native people in the Americas that, you know, before hadn't been explained in the Bible and things like that and what that meant. So I find that fascinating because you also mentioned early on in the introduction that, you know, when you bring up anything to Clive and Bundy about other people's rights to the land or sense of sacredness to the land or use of the land, when you mention anything about Native Americans, it just doesn't, it doesn't fit with him. And I wonder if there's this sense that because of the way they perceive who Native Americans might have been, that it can all be explained away as still being part of this Mormon philosophy, or prophecy rather, Mormon prophecy that it was supposed to be for them. So even though this was a group of people who had been sort of cast out and ended up, ultimately they're just bringing them back around into the church. So you don't actually owe anything to indigenous people to occupy this land.
That's a really, really interesting question. First of all, I think that this idea of Ham and Noah's son Ham being cast out and considered of color was something that came about later than the Middle Ages. I think it was in and around people trying to justify slavery, the British and American sort of religious figures. I think that's right. That's what I recall, that idea would have happened right around then. Joseph Smith never specifically, that I know of, talked about Ham, but he did have this mythology of the tribes of Israel.
Lost tribes of Israel.
Yeah. Yeah. And so in the Book of Mormon, they're known as Lamanites.
That's right. You talked about then two groups, the Lamanites
and the Nephites. Right. Yeah, the Lamanites and the Nephites, who over centuries fought, and, you know, sometimes one was in power, sometimes another was in power. But the Lamanites were punished with dark skin.
Were they two sons of Ham?
Or of Laman.
Of Laman, okay.
I think, no, Laman was the Lamanite. Nephi was the son. Who was the father?
That's what I'm saying. I wasn't sure, but they were both to be considered maybe occupying the Americas?
Yeah, so okay. Laman and Nephi were two brothers who came to the Americas, and they were the ones who created the Nephites and the Lamanites.
According to the Mormon
According
theology.
To the Book of Mormon. Okay. And the Book of Mormon is literal, so it's a history. Mm-hmm. So what you're talking about is absolutely right, that Clive and Bundy would see indigenous people as Lamanites and all that means theologically. There was a belief that Joseph Smith put forth in, it was in the Book of Mormons and he also talked about it, that in converting indigenous people or Lamanites, they would become white. White and delightsome is the quote. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, you are hastening the second coming. You're hastening revelation. You're hastening the coming of God.
Fascinating.
And so there is that theological belief. Now, with Cliven, I actually think his history starts with the first Mormon settler. And I think it's less a conscious sort of belief in, you know, indigenous people are going to be converted and that's going to usher in the coming of, or the second coming. I actually believe that he only thinks about, because when I talked to him, he said, you got to remember, it was, you know, when the first, I'll never forget this because I did a TED talk about it, or a TEDx talk about it, but, you know, when the first Mormon settler, and he was kind of talking about his ancestor, so I had in mind, he was talking about Nephi Johnson, came to this area, and his horse drank out of the Virgin River. That's when it became his. That's when he claimed ownership of it. And that goes back to laws. I mean, just in terms of utilizing, what is it? Something use.
Yeah. It's the use of rights, the usufruct laws, the use right laws. That's how, and that goes back to Smith, I believe. Is that right? That you have to use the land.
You have to
and you have
to
be using it. And that's kind of was the basis for the Homestead Act, to
improving
up. But that goes much farther back to England, of that if you're using it, then you have, you then exert your claim.
Beneficial use. It's the first beneficial use. So he talks about that in terms of the legalese, but or the legal aspects of it. But what he also fails to remember is that the day before the Mormon horse drank out of the Virgin River, it was a Southern Paiute River.
Right.
And so that's his.
And he won't hear that.
Right. Yeah.
When you say that, that's just not a.
It doesn't compute.
Because he doesn't see their use as maybe considered the same as a beneficial use.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit. Are you finished with that thought with that kind of explaining the Bundy family? Do you want to say any more about the Bundys?
No. Okay. I forgive me for being a little bit rusty on some of these terms.
No, you're fine. I know how it is when you've written something a couple of years ago. It's just not right there. It's not for me either. Yeah.
So what made you use the Bundys, though, in this book? Like, what was it, that meeting that you had with them? Did their central, the way that they are focused in on this movement, or what was it that kind of drew you to the Bundy family?
Well, it was the way that they used Mormon theology to justify their war. Mm, okay. And, you know, as I said at the beginning of this podcast, I became really interested in the way religious worldview informs the way we relate to the land. And in the case of the Bundys, the way that they related to the land had very much to do with early church theology. Mm-hmm. The idea that the Constitution is sacred, that it's their sacred responsibility to uphold it, that they have a special relationship to the Constitution. These are all things that Joseph Smith talked to early church adherents about, in particular, he was focused on the First Amendment, so the freedom to practice religion. So this is a different take. But there is a prophecy that's apocryphal, most likely, that Joseph Smith said that there's going to come a time when the Constitution is hanging by a thread, and essentially it's up to the Mormon people to uphold the Constitution and fight a corrupt government. So this is something that he has really embraced, and his sons have embraced this idea that they are on a mission, a religious mission, to protect the Constitution. And because they don't think that the federal government can own public land, mm-hmm. their they're fighting when the Constitution is hanging by a thread. Now, this case, I mean, this has been brought up to various, during various legal, that this case has come up over and over again, and the federal government can indeed own public land, mm-hmm. but the Bundys think that they know the Constitution better than constitutional scholars.
Right.
And that has to do with the fact that they, essentially the Constitution in the Mormon Church is part of a sacred canon. And that's one of the benefits, I guess, of being an American religion.
Wow. Or
one of the aspects.
Right. And the Constitution, so they wear the Constitutions in their pockets.
Yeah, they do.
And and talk a little bit about, I'm going to skip ahead, but talk a little bit about that Constitution and how they use it and why they wear it in their pockets and why that they just adhere to this.
I'm not sure I have a good answer that, other than, you know, they're nifty little pocket-sized constitutions. I can tell you a little bit about the history.
Yeah.
So those constitutions were manufactured, or they were printed, rather, by an organization run by a man named Cleon Skousen, okay. who was a Mormon and also had these very deep beliefs about the Mormons, or sort of the Mormon culture and their role in upholding the Constitution. He was affiliated with the John Birch Society. He wrote a book, among other books, called The Naked Communist. He was very much politically in line with McCarthy, as was Ezra Taft Benson, who I believe he was in the Eisenhower administration, and he was a prophet with the Mormon Church. And so Cleon Skousen and Ezra Taft Benson were major right-wing agitators in the church, so much so that Cleon was in trouble with the church. I mean, he may have, at some point, Cleon Skousen was a rabble-rouser.
Okay.
And he was a right-wing rabble-rouser. Mm-hmm. And so he's the one, it was the Freeman Institute, and it later became known as another name, but when he started it was the Freeman Institute, mm-hmm. and he created these pocket constitutions.
Okay.
So there's a lot of overlapping between sort of the political will that can draw on religion, can draw on sense of land use and rights, but it's a lot of this very libertarian, individual, anti-government kind of rhetoric, which, you know, a lot of it then movements can come upon each other and sort of reinforce each other. I want to take this back around and zoom out a little bit. But I love this chapter in your book you call Two Gods. And for me, it's, you know, it's talking about this, you know, essence of what your research is about, which is about religion, belief, theology, sacredness, and land and concepts of what makes it, you know, sacred or important. And you say to Joseph Smith, land became sacred through human industry. You know, what you were going to do to put it to beneficial use, to improve it, to change it, you know. Whereas at this very same time, as Joseph Smith is even becoming a prophet, right, and starting his religion in the East Coast, we have Emerson, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And of course, he has a very different view of religion, spirituality, and landscape. And then you say to Emerson, by contrast, lands without the imprint of humans were divine. And this is very much plays into kind of Muir and the untrammeled and Bill, you know, Cronin saying, you know, it used to be that wilderness were those scary places where the devil dwelt, whereas then it became the place where you find God, you know, when you go on your own. And that's what Emerson was about. So we have Smith and Emerson at this very same moment in time having very different messages about sacredness, God, and land in America. take us now to where we are and understand where we are now in the West with those ideas and how their histories have trickled into not just the Bundys, but kind of where we are right now. Just muse on that for me, because I love how that chapter kind of gave us the historical grounding for very different viewpoints.
Yeah, I think that we're really reevaluating things right now. I'm working on a new book that's looking at the way we perceive the West and the way we perceive lands. And I think there are a number of things that are happening. I think that conservationists are having to look at their history and their heroes and, take them down a notch. I mean, John Muir with the Sierra Club, I don't know if you've heard about what's happening with the Sierra Club, but there's a lot of internal sort of discussion about John Muir and his history being fraught.
He can't stand that pedestal, you know.
Well, there's those that, I mean, it's been fascinating. There are those that want to completely throw him out and not even have John Muir be a part of the Sierra Club anymore. And there are those saying he really did, throughout his life, he evolved. And so I think that, and I'm not taking, I don't have enough of a dog in that fight to take one side or another, but I think it's really important to give the environmental heroes or the conservation heroes a hard look. But also to keep them in the context of their time. I think that's really important. I know that Ed Abbey has been taken to task quite a bit. And there's a wonderful book called Desert Cabal by Amy Irvine, which, you know, really looks at his legacy. Mm-hmm. And she's fantastic. And so, you know, that said, Desert Solitaire, when I read that book, I became unbelievably enamored of that part of the world. I mean, it was one of the reasons why I fell so head over heels in with that part of the West. So again, you know, these are imperfect people, but they need to be looked at. And in terms of the way we view things now, I'm so afraid that there is a culture in our country of having so little understanding of the West that they come to consume it. And I think we saw it like crazy when people finally got out of their houses and drove their Sprinter vans or their, you know, whatever to the West, to the national parks, and they were absolutely inundated. And I was talking to a woman who was on the Pole Bridge entry gate of Glacier. Have you all ever been to Pole Bridge?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So it's pretty remote.
Yes.
And people flocked there because it was one of the places that was unticketed. So because it was so crowded, you had your pass and you had your parking permit, but you also needed a ticket.
Yes.
They were trying to regulate it. So mm-hmm. people decided that they were going to go to the Pole Bridge entrance, and it was a gravel road, and they were driving their rental cars there. They had no understanding of where they, I mean, this is one of the most important pieces of the Crown of the Continent ecosystem. It is absolutely exquisite. It's a matrix of Forest Service land, park land, sovereign land at Blackfeet, private land, and the Bob Marshall Wilderness. It has grizzly bears, wolves, lynx, wolverine, mountain lions. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievably wild. And she said people would come, they had no idea what they were doing. They had no idea how to access the land. There was toilet paper everywhere. People were parked at every single stream access, trailhead, you know, any little place that they could pull off, and they would camp.
This is because of the pandemic.
Because they were just trying to get to
everything
this
was so shut down in Glacier.
Wilderness, you know, it's like the wild, let's go, you know, to nature. And so, but there was so little understanding. And one of the things she talked about was that there was a line of people hiking to Grinnell Glacier, which is the one of the glaciers that's receding.
Yeah.
so that they could do a selfie there and put it on their Instagram. Like they waited an hour for hours to take a picture of the Grinnell Glacier so they could put it up on social media, which to me is so profoundly weird that you're going into a park maybe for the first time, you're escaping COVID. I get that. You want to get out of the house, finally be in somewhere that you don't need to wear a mask, but you're so ill-prepared for what you're experiencing, and you go to an iconic glacier that's melting because of climate change, and you put it up on your Instagram. It all just seems so discordant. You know what I mean?
Yes. This is very much what my husband's art is about. And when he, after they did Glacier as a collaboration with two other artists, he went to Rocky Mountain National Park, and he said it was so crowded.
Yeah.
And this was all pre-COVID, but he said there he would never go back.
Yeah.
And so he's always seeking, you know, he's gone to Antarctica now. He's just always seeking remote places. But he's going there to document, to witness, to tell the story in collaboration with scientists. And so I love the work that he does. And people are very fascinated by what he's doing. But he even says, you know, he's getting to an age where there's only so many more times he'll be able to get to these places. And so it is so interesting to hear then that juxtaposition of these people wanting to access something but having no idea what they're getting into. So tell us a little bit about what it is you're working on now, so we can kind of end this discussion with where your research is going now and your next book project.
Well, I'm writing a book called A True West: Sorting Realities on the Far Side of America. Mm-hmm. And it's about what you're talking about. It's about mythology. It's essentially, what are the altars that we're building on our myth museums? How do we, as the West, you know, as we're living in the West today, what is it that we're enshrining that's dangerous and perhaps metastasizing? And what are we as Westerners doing to be back in relationship with each other? I think that the thing that I love about this project is I spent the Trump years being really angry at people. And I have had the opportunity to spend a lot of time in rural Western communities in conversation with people, and I am getting such a different perspective. I am feeling so much less angry and more connected. And it's this book has been a blast because it has a lot to do with history, because, you know, the Western history is filled with mythology. And also it's talking about climate change, pandemic, and political polarization, as well as the influx of people moving into this area and really changing the culture. So I've had these wide-ranging conversations, and I know this sounds like my topic's quite broad, but it's all interconnected. I mean, it's all absolutely tied together. Mm-hmm. So my conversations hit on each of these things. And I've had the opportunity to talk to, I'm a Buddhist monk in the San Luis Valley, which is a Spanish land grant series of communities in Western Colorado. A woman who has left the church she grew up in LDS, and she's left the church, and she now lives in Escalante, Utah, which is right on the monument, mm-hmm. and talks about how she's too conservative for all the bougie people moving in, and too liberal for her Mormon family, but that she can occupy both spaces, and she kind of gets both, you know, communities.
Yeah.
And I've talked to this fabulous rancher in Terry, Montana, who spent the first hour we were together telling me how much he hated Democrats and he hates the government and he's collecting guns. And do I want to go to his ranch? And so I went and spent a weekend at his ranch. And I have to tell you, I adore this man. He took me to the Evelyn Cameron Museum, which is amazing. Yeah. They actually have two. I just think the world of this human. And he's given me faith in reconciliation and relationship building. But I've also spent time with militia people who have left the militia and left this Christian nationalist sort of culture in Eastern Washington. I can't even tell. I've met this fabulous guy who grew up also in Mormon culture, who is trying to put together a big proposal. It's not a national monument. I think it's a national preservation area. And he's trying to do that in outside of Idaho Falls. Mm-hmm. So it's, it just is. I mean, I talked to Jill Momaday, who is F. Scott Momaday's daughter. Wow. And I've talked to Chris Latray, who's this fabulous Métis poet over in Missoula. I've had so many. I mean, I've probably talked to about 100 people. And
are you stalking them all on Facebook? How are you getting to know them?
I go into communities and say, like, it's all started with my friend Alvin, who's a farmer in Glendive. Mm-hmm. And he said, meet my friend. He worked for the railroad for all these many years. And I also interviewed this fabulous Maasai. He's now a naturalized U.S. citizen. He's in Spokane. He's a Maasai artist who did part of the mural for the Black Lives Matter downtown Spokane. So I've been able to meet with people who live in the West and ask them about how they see things, what is important to them, what are they hopeful about, what are they worried about, and it's really been one of the coolest things I've ever done.
And I think that's the only way we're going to get back to a place of understanding is just to talk to each other.
We have to.
And just to rebuild our relationships.
We have to not be afraid and make the effort. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Just going into communities and doing archaeology has given me opportunities to go into small rural towns, and I have found it just so productive. And again, I feel the same way you do, that I have some hope, because you find common ground with these very interesting people who initially you think you would have nothing in common with, or they approach you thinking they'll have nothing in common with you, and then you build trust, and it's helpful.
Find out you do have more common ground than you think you would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I will say that, you know, I've come up against Q. I've come up against Christian nationalists. I've come up against QAnon people, Christian nationalists, that I know that there is going to be, you know, there are people that you cannot get to. Yeah. But when I talked to this man that I was mentioning, he started out telling me he'd been radicalized. And that, to me, means something, because I know what people who are radicalized are capable of doing. Mm-hmm. And when I went to his ranch and talked to him, and he wrote me the most beautiful letter afterwards. He's not been radicalized, but he just wrote, if you and I were in charge of everything, we would get so much done, which is hilarious because we are so politically different, but we liked each other. And then he said, keep me in your heart. You'll always be in mine. Mm-hmm. And that gave me so much hope, and that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we are all looking forward to your next book, and we hope that every politician in the West reads it and makes better, well-informed decisions because of it, right? And and I think, you know, maybe somewhere down the line you start your own podcast as well, because it sounds like you have some really interesting people to talk to. Yeah.
Or we'll have you back on this.
Yeah,
one.
No, yeah. I'm sure. I think you guys have, you run the podcast show. I'll leave it to you.
Okay. Well, we'll just have you back.
Yeah.
So, Betsy, there's so much more we'd love to discuss with you, but we have, alas, run out of time. So thanks so much for taking the time today. And American Zion is such an important read. We encourage everyone out there to find a copy. And we'll, again, have links to that on the website. So we encourage you to also check out Betsy's website, which is www.betsygaineskwaman.com, and watch for her next book.
When will it be out, Betsy? When is the...
It's the fall of 2023.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's not too far in the future.
No, a little,
a little too soon for you.
Is, yes.
The pressure's on.
Yes.
Right. Well, thank you, Betsy, so much for being here today.
Thank you, Crystal and Nancy. It was fun. It was really fun.
Should be
fun. I'm so excited about your work, and I'm a huge fan.
Good. Wonderful. We're so glad to hear that. Well, thank you, Betsy, and thanks to all our listeners out there for joining us today. If you love the podcast, please tell a friend and make sure to subscribe so it shows up in your podcast feed each week. And make sure to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. We love those 5-star reviews. So thanks for listening today, and we hope you can join us again to find out more about the dirt on the past.
A big thank you to our editor and sound guru, Steve Durbin. Thanks to Lawson Alegria for mixing the music, and to John Chadwell for help getting this podcast out in the world.